You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Thing that I have done.
Yes, and you gotta love Wham, when George Michael was obviously still alive, and primarily when he was still as young as he was there back, and when he had the group. They technically were thought to be a duo, but they were actually a group because they also had two backup singers, two ladies, which, you know, the other partner to Wham, I keep forgetting that guy's name. He married apparently one of them. But yeah, that was when George Michael was still in Wham and the song Freedom. Not to be confused with the other Freedom that he later on sang in his own solo career. That one was a little bit more touching, you know, a little bit more somber, I would rather say. But on that note, dear listeners, welcome and good morning to this Sunday morning session of my Sunday morning take here in your number one talk radio station. And as always, you're in my company from 5 a.m. up until 7 a.m., wherever you might be, wherever you are. And if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. I'm talking about waking up Namibian time, guys, just to let you know, because there is a lot of listeners out there specifically that are in many different time zones across the world. And yes, they do listen to us through our application. Sometimes through our website. In other scenarios, obviously the majority of you are in Namibia on the frequency discussion. Now, as we always do here on my Sunday morning take, we take a look at some interesting talking points that we obviously don't get to carry or to dissect during the course of the week. That obviously being on the home run, that's between myself and Helmut. However, for this morning's session, I also realized that now, while sitting here, just waiting for the songs to end, that I probably should have played a little bit more somber music, primarily for the particular discussion that we're going to be taking a look at. The discussion for this morning, has to do primarily with looking at the problems that we call it now the country, the DRC, but the problems that the Congo have had since 1960. I say since 1960 specifically because that's when they all actually started. Now, we will be dissecting, dear listeners, a discussion that in many scenarios we've not actually exhausted back in last year, 2025, we, on the home run, we had a look specifically at the modern day, crisis or, sort of like instability element of East DRC, primarily to do with what the activities of M23 and the FDLR. The FDLR is the DRC army sponsored / DRC government sponsored a proxy paramilitary, and M23 is identified as the one Rwanda-sponsored, rebel group. They call them a rebel group. In other scenarios, it's a proxy. In other scenarios, it's a paramilitary. However, DRC's problems go way, way, way back. Now, as we start off on this particular timeline, I have to let you know, dear listeners, the timeline itself is pretty long. And the timeline itself starts off very interesting. The timeline itself, obviously, as you do know, is obviously a discussion that stems from the Berlin Conference of 1884. But, or 1883, basically, because those guys were there for a long time. But when you look at the timeline from 1960, things firstly looked upbeat, they looked promising, but then they also quickly, they also quickly developed into a not so good position for many people specifically, for many citizens, for many ordinary people specifically in the DRC. Now, as we start off on this particular discussion, obviously, since 1950, self-determination, sovereignty, as well as also independence became the theme and the discussion of many particular countries that were known as colonies around the world at that time. Obviously, since 1950, we're talking about a period wherein the United Nations was already started, a period with wherein countries or colonial powers like the United Kingdom and France realized they cannot be present everywhere. Developments obviously that also led to various particular territories actually either having violent uprisings to achieve their independence, or in another scenario, the colonial master at the time realized, you know what, we technically can't handle this particular territory anymore. The Second World War bankrupted us. We've got to access the Marshall Plan from the United States. We've got to restructure, rebuild, and do all this. And the people who are subjects in these colonial territories have to realize that, they should run themselves. Now, on the African continent, the discussion was, in majority, the discussion was very clear about specifically how territories that are colonies are to be run. They are to be run by the central governments of the colonial power. But when we come into our specific discussion of this morning, looking at the DRC, as many of us know, was technically like the personal farm of the Belgian King Leopold. Now, Leopold treated obviously the particular territory of what we know as the Congo, or that time as the Congo, but it also included, you know, Congo Brazzaville. So it was technically the whole Zaire, which was its old name. But Zaire, there was Zaire pre 1900, and then it became the Congo, and then when obviously independence had to come, it was split into two. But just so that you know, there were technically, there was a time that the two Congos were one, twice in history where they were one. One, the one scenario was when they became a, basically a Belgian territory, but more like a Belgian royal asset, should I rather call it. Because obviously it was deemed as a personal property of the Belgian king at the time. I don't know if it's Leopold III or Leopold II. Just have to find his name here. But this obviously was a talking point in terms of how, Leopold II, of how the particular territory was administered. Now, to set the scene specifically, there is a particular point in 1960. It's technically known as 11 July 1960, where a specific event happened when independence was claimed. But I won't mention the event now, because the event was supposedly known as the Katanga Crisis in 1960. On 11 July 1960, this particular time date in history, the Katanga Crisis happens. But we've got to go a little bit further back in terms of understanding what actually happened here. And for that, dear listeners, we'll be coming back right after the break, specifically starting off with a time frame that leads into the, firstly, the self-determination and independence, you know, realization. And then immediately after achieving the sovereignty on and the sovereign identity of the DRC, we roll into that particular talking point of events and a time frame of events. One of them actually that led to the demise of Patrice Lumumba. Just to realize that the man was 30 years old when he passed away is a pretty frightening and a pretty sad scenario. It's also the same thing for Martin Luther King. If you guys did not know, he was like 31 when he also passed away. yeah. So the dimensions obviously cite a discussion that shows people that, you know what, some particular understanding of some particular elements needs to be dissected. And we'll be doing that on this morning session of My Sunday Morning Take. But before that, we quickly take a short musical break and we come back right after that.
Champagne from a fast food restaurant, paper cup, candle conversations in a power cup. Sometimes broken plans can end up better than when they're not breaking up. So I won't settle down, no I won't settle down for a while. And it feels like it's been a long time.
the champion of the world. I can't explain, but I wanna try. But is this image of you and I? And it goes dancing by. All these secrets that I can't keep. I give my heart there, that hotel suite. And you lived there so long. It's kind of strange now you're gone. I'm not sure if I should show you what I found. Has it gone for good? Or is it coming back around? Isn't it hard to make up your mind? When you're losing and your fuse is fireside, there's all those places we used to go, and I suspect you already know. But that place on memory lane you like still looks the same, but something about it's changed. I'm not sure if I should show you what I found. Has it gone for good, or is it coming back around? Isn't it hard to make up your mind when you're losing and your fuse is fireside? And I thought I was yours forever. Or maybe I was mistaken, but I just cannot manage to make it through the day without thinking that you were late. Isn't it hard to make up your mind when you're losing and your fuse is fireside?
And we come back there from the sounds of fireside, sung by the Arctic Monkeys. Before that, it was the song The Champion, sung by the group Take That. You're here on your number one talk radio station. This is My Sunday Morning Take, and we're delving straight, or head first, or, you know, straight into our, where we left off with our talking point specifically this morning. Now, okay, let me explain to you primarily how I had to look at this particular talking point. So, it's very difficult, dear listeners, if you try to find extensive and thus also, highly informative and in-depth discussions about African history in a particular timeline as what Northern Hemisphere and the rest of the world history has been outlined. This is regular exercise where I always do this particular thing of looking at this day in history exercise, and it's a pretty easy Google search that you can do yourself, and one of the first particular, you know, resources that'll pop up will give you a lovely timeline of predominantly Western history and talking points and events. When it comes to specifically trying to find anything African, it is very, 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 very minimal. Many scenarios, it is predominantly European and North American history points. So I did the same thing, just tweaked a word here and there and included the word Africa and then see what results basically came up. Now, when one of the results came up, luckily for me, since it was 11 July yesterday, I had the opportunity of, you know, seeing a resource that actually listed what they called the Katanga Crisis. It's actually known as the Congo crisis in its broader length and in its broader fit. Now, the Congo crisis, dear listeners, happens in a particular time when Belgium decided to hand over independence to the inhabitants of what we now know today as the DRC. They handed it over. But a lot of things still came with strings attached. Now, I know in some cases, the knowledge obviously that I've got contained here in front of me probably was polished between 1960 and up to now. They've probably been polished like 100,000 times before. In many cases, you also have to take things with a huge, huge heap of salt, not a grain of salt, but a huge heap of salt, because you also have to be sort of like, not suspicious, rather, but you can't take what you have in front of you specifically as the ultimate just word. Unless you can discover something else that brings in a new dimension to the knowledge, or has a different perspective to the knowledge, or actually changes the timeline in terms of events. Unfortunately, I don't have that luxury. However, the Congo crisis itself does not speak more to a celebratory history, but more to a very sad history. This is a history so sad that it sounds like a Shakespearean tragedy itself, written by the bard himself, and basically brought to us, and held and brought to us here in the 20th century. Now, the Congo crisis, which speaks to the history of the Democratic Republic of Congo, dear listeners, was the triggering of events behind the Congo crisis that were the mutiny of the army. The first particular event was the mutiny of the army. This was known as the Force Publique near the city or the town of Leopoldville on 5 July, and the subsequent intervention of Belgian paratroopers, ostensibly to protect the lives of Belgian citizens. Now, adding to the confusion was a constitutional impasse. This was a constitutional roadblock, a constitutional divide that placed the country's new president and its prime minister against each other and brought the Congolese government to a halt. In Congo's first national elections, Lumumba's MNC party had outpolled Kasavubu's ABAKO, ABAKO was the party's name, and its allies, but neither side could form a parliamentary coalition. Now, as a compromise measure, Kasavubu and Lumumba formed an uneasy partnership, with the former as president and the latter as a premier. Now, on 5 September of that particular year, however, Kasavubu relieved Lumumba of his functions, and Lumumba responded by dismissing Kasavubu. Now, I quickly want to just put my bookmark in there. Now, in many cases, dear listeners, when we hear of Lumumba, we don't hear about him, his particular public spat with his own president. The president of the country and the prime minister of the country that actually brought about said particular events. Now, ask yourself, okay, they refused to form a parliamentary coalition or governmental coalition. They refused to achieve a compromise between each other. They refused to basically work to each other, but the election polls told everyone that these two particular entities, ABAKO with its coalition and MNC with its particular large majority, or singular majority, they needed to work together with each other. Remember, this is a pretty large country, specifically also in the Southern African context, a pretty large country. Pretty large country that also has the economic potential that we've only been hearing, but we've never truly seen a realization take place or it being achieved. Now, you can obviously now see, dear listeners, that when you have a prime minister and a president, not from the same political parties, who were political opponents at the same elections, you obviously can understand that there's going to be friction. Now ask yourself, why would there be friction? Why would there be friction? Now, it's one of the first particular things that we ourselves have even seen here in Namibian localized politics, where you try to understand the basis for the friction. You try to understand the basis for the talking points, the discourse, the accusations in many cases that come about. And then you sit there wondering, what is this? Is this something that impacts my life in a day-to-day scenario? Or is this just highly publicized mudslinging in many cases? Now, we've obviously been lucky as a country for the better part of our 36-year history to technically have a scenario where the prime minister of the government and the president, the national leader, both come from the same party. I don't want to imagine a scenario where the one is from a different party and the other is from a different party in the same particular case as what happened here with the DRC in the 60s. I don't want a different kind of a scenario. I don't want a scenario to look like this. Now remember, this was at a particular time when the rest of Africa were starting to ask questions about, you know what, why can't we be independent? Why must we be governed out of Europe or from wherever? Obviously, Namibia's case was a little bit different because we were colonized by a fellow African country. And I once again put to you the particular talking point of, think to yourself across this African continent. Why is it that the territories, the countries that were British zones of influence, why have they been more stable than the French-speaking zones of this continent? Just go think to yourself, guys. Why? It's not to say that there has not been any format of conflict or potential political unrest in the British government, in the former British government zones, but it's a thing that I could not have put my finger on in terms of identifying what is the single most, you know, obvious factor that still allows the Anglophone African countries to be slightly more stable than the Francophone countries, to be slightly more stable, to be way more stable than the Lusophone speaking African countries. The Lusophones are obviously Angola, Mozambique, Gabon, because they're the only ones that have Spanish. I did not know that they had Spanish, but when for some reason there's a Spanish-French sort of like scenario. Sao Tome and Principe, Cabo Verde, Madagascar is the other African, is the other French-speaking, former French-speaking country, which now recently had its own particular instability element. But factor these talking points in, factor these scenarios in of why is it that the English-speaking African countries seem to be just that little bit more stable? Why? I can't put my hand or my finger or identify to you one thing, because we would have to go into every scenario, every case study in Africa. But on the face of it, we just look okay. We just look okay. But I'm digressing greatly. Now, as a result, obviously after after Lumumba decided to dismiss his own president, which I've never heard of. How does a prime minister try to dismiss a president? But after Lumumba dismissed Kasavubu, and Kasavubu obviously relieved Lumumba of his functions. So Kasavubu first fired Lumumba, and Lumumba then said, yes, you as the president, I'm going to remove you of your functions, which is weird. But anyway, as a result of the chaos that emanated from this particular activity, there were two groups that were now claiming to be this legal central government. And I will tell you this again, dear listeners, none of us recite or factor in this particular event in history of DRC. None of us do this. Now, I feel sorry for Patrice Lumumba for what happened to him. But I do not feel sorry for him for this activity. Let me say it again. I feel sorry for the man, what happened to him. But I do not feel sorry for what he did specifically. We have to identify eggs for eggs. Milk for milk. You know, identify items for items. Here's the thing. He knows what he was doing, and Kasavubu knew what he was doing. They both knew what they were doing. And in the broader sense of the discussions that we see, who is the head of state? A president or a monarch? Okay? In very few instances, for example, like in Europe, the prime minister becomes the face of all government or national interactions in the international realm, in the international relations realm around the world. For example, Giorgia Meloni, which is the highly publicized Italian prime minister. The Germans don't have a prime minister. They have a chancellor. If you did not know, that would be Friedrich Merz. Keir Starmer, who is now resigned, he's resigned, but he's sort of like working out his resignation period. Who else is there? There is Mark Carney from Canada. There is the guy from Australia, the guy from New Zealand. These are the people you would see in a broader sense, but they are representing governments, which represent nations. Right? Ne? But when you come into the scenario, for example, like what happened, what our president is doing, or what Ramaphosa would be doing, they would be the faces that the rest of the world interacts with when they go on official visits and state visits. So our president, President Nandi Ndaitwa, President Cyril Ramaphosa, President Duma Boko, they go out and they engage with the world, whereas their prime ministers stay at home and look after affairs. Because during this past week, that the president had been in China, Prime Minister Ngurare was in parliament. Now, I read a joke, or it was more like a tongue-in-cheek session or thing that one of the journalists on the parliamentary WhatsApp group said, was that, so if the opposition party MPs want questions answered, they have to wait for some of the ministers who are on the particular official visit with the president in China to come back and then for them to respond. Which is a definite yes. Which is a definite yes. I mean, how else do you want an answer like that? But the president took a bunch of her ministers with, ministers who are responsible for certain particular dimensions of the Namibian economy, and they are now engaging on an international relations platform. Now, I'm showing you the best case scenario, right? The best case scenario. This is obviously as our ministers, our prime minister, and our president come from the same political party. We don't have a situation like what happened to Lumumba and Kasavubu. But this particular dimension obviously does not, you know, deviate from the reality of what was. This particular dimension actually shows you these guys were in a pretty public spat. They were in a pretty public argument. Now, on 11 July of that year of 1960, let me just be sure about the particular time period. Yeah. On 11 July of 1960, the country's richest province, Katanga, decided to declare itself independent from the leadership of, from the particular central government, which was obviously based in Kinshasa. Now, the guy who decided to do this, it sounds very similar also to like the Caprivi Zambezi / Zambezi cessationist dimension. It's just that, obviously, Zambezi is not Namibia's richest province. I'm sorry, guys, but Zambezi is not Namibia's richest province, technically speaking. So, Moise Tshombe was the political actor involved or particularly responsible for the DRC province of Katanga announcing independence from the, you know, DRC Kinshasa government. Now, the support was given by Belgium for Katanga to achieve this particular reality. And this lent credibility to Lumumba's claims that Brussels was trying to reimpose its authority. And on 12 July, Lumumba and Kasavubu appealed to the UN together. These guys are publicly dividing the country into two camps, but then they decide when Katanga announces independence from their, you know, clowning about in Kinshasa, they decide to go to the UN and ask for support. Now, they asked the Secretary General at the time, Dag Hammarskjöld, for UN security assistance. While this was obviously intended to pave the way for restoration of peace and order, when the UN peacekeeping force arrived in DRC, it actually added to the tension between Kasavubu and Lumumba. Now, Lumumba's insistence that the UN should, if necessary, use force to bring Katanga back under control of the central government was met with categorical opposition from Kasavubu. Lumumba then appealed to the Soviet Union for logistical assistance to send troops to Katanga. And at that point, the Congo crisis became inextricably bound up with East-West animosity in the context of the Cold War. Now, when you look at the modern aspect of United Nations peacekeeping forces, for example, let's say, there's the Lebanon one known as UNIFIL, and then there is the, the one that was also for East DRC up until the middle of last year, when the accusations started popping up that the UN peacekeeping force in East DRC were being accused by members there in East DRC of rape and murder. Now, this is a little bit of a problematic scenario. When I say problematic, this specifically speaks towards some sort of a political narrative that is being developed there in such scenarios where a UN peacekeeping force is based. Guys, if you've ever spoken to someone, let's for example say, if you've ever spoken to a person that was on a UN peacekeeping force, because Namibia is part of that particular, you know, cluster of nations that is seldomly used for peacekeeping. And you would be used for peacekeeping like on the African continent. Now, if you've ever met a Namibian who has been on a peacekeeping mission before, whether they be NAMPOL or NDF, ask them about the animosity, about how the local communities in those countries, firstly, the one face that they show these peacekeepers and the other face that the peacekeepers hear about, meaning the gossip, the accusations, the things that happen. In many cases, it's primarily because they know that these people are internationals, or foreigners, and that, you know, there is some sort of a political actor in the region trying to get these peacekeepers out, or, you know, basically to try and discredit the peacekeeping missions. There's also a peacekeeping mission in South Sudan, just so that you know, because every now and then when I open up my YouTube feed of the United Nations Security Council meetings, there's a reporting that is given by the guy in charge of the peacekeeping efforts in South Sudan. And every time now and then I hear South Sudan is always on the cusp of getting back into a civil war. Now you understand what these peacekeeping missions actually go through. Because you had instances, for example, like Lumumba, who wanted to use bullets against his own citizens. Look, if anyone has had a high standing of the man, because I felt sorry for the guy in terms of how he passed away, how he died. But realizing that he's one of the causes of the modern day issues that DRC sit with, then how do you wish to afford any kind of sympathy? How do you wish to afford any kind of sympathy? There is obviously also a great misunderstanding back in the 60s regarding what international relations looked like. I think this is a key dimension that we also have to dissect. Back in the 60s, with specifically African countries, Southeast Asian countries, and some South American entities, the idea around how international relations took place and the resolution of disputes, you know, to resolve disputes between internal parties, because I mean, a dispute between you and your president is definitely a Congolese dispute. It is not a Soviet Union dispute. It is not a UN Security Council dispute. It is an internal sovereign dispute. But it does also place the nation basically on a major level of alert, because we all know what political actors are known for. You can pull it all from the European contexts, huh? I looked at you guys remember the event that started the First World War, the gunshot to the Archduke of Yugoslavia. That guy, that Austro-Hungarian prince. Now that guy was the cousin to the Austro-Hungarian emperor, just to let you know. What's his name? Is it Franz Ferdinand? Yeah. Now, Franz, not our Franz from Eagle FM. Please, guys. I'm speaking to that deceased Austro-Hungarian, royalty. That guy, and I watched the documentary like recently, like at the start of this year. Franz Ferdinand. When this particular documentary researcher went and looked at, you know, what, why was this guy shot and killed in, is it Sarajevo or is it in, Belgrade? One of the two. Why was he shot or Zagreb? It was either Zagreb, Sarajevo, or Belgrade that he was shot. Why was he shot by an unknown guy with a pistol? Well, when they looked into this guy, because remember, he's an archduke. He's just a high-ranking nobleman slash royal family member of the Austro-Hungarian family. He's not the emperor. When they looked into this guy's particular past or his life, this researcher for this documentary, he stumbled upon this guy's personal life. Now, you are lucky in 2025, in 2026, to stumble upon a guy's life who was, was kept very well for 100 plus years. The researcher realized that Franz Ferdinand was a rampant philanderer. Let me say it again. He was a rampant philanderer. Not even polygamous, this thing of that TV show, The Polygamist, that people were now writing essays about on social media for no reason that I don't read. I'm talking about a philanderer was, you know, everybody knew that he was, you know, the talk of the town as a nobleman. He was so bad in his philandering, that an STD that he contracted created his wife's sterility. His wife became sterile because of his philandering. That's how bad it was. He only had, was it two daughters or one daughter? No, sorry. They only had three kids. And then it ended there. Because she became sterile after the third child. Because of these continuous infections that homeboy kept bringing back home. No, literally, guys. It was bad. His wife obviously also knew about all the girlfriends and the particular partners that he had. But it was a dimension that literally, if you look at it, it looks like a royal scandal. But one of the partners was actually linked to the guy that shot Franz Ferdinand when he was later on older and he went to that particular public event there in the former Yugoslavia, which was part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it was these particular events that culminated in his demise and his death, which then sparked off the First World War, which was a fight between cousins. Now let's pull a string from that particular element and we get into a major miscalculation in the international relations realm by Lumumba and Kasavubu. Now, I agree with Kasavubu. Don't bring foreign actors into your country to try and solve your problems. But then also, this is the big reality that politicians don't want to own up to. In many cases, like what I've learned over the course of the 5, 6, 7 years since COVID heading this way. In many cases, politicians, government officials, when they inform us, the rest of the world, the rest of the country, they speak down to us. as if we are people there that, you know, we're on a need to know basis. No, really, guys. No, really. Go look at some of the presentations, discussions that take place. They speak down to us. In some cases, they call a public stakeholder engagement, where they will only give, you know, presenting their stuff, their sides. They call that as engagement. And you obviously wanted to understand what further contributions can be made. And then you are told, write a letter. You write a letter. You probably don't get a response. And then the story ends there. And then you hear that it was a bill, the draft of a bill. And then it shows up in Parliament, which you will watch on the national broadcaster. And at the Parliament level, the MPs there don't know where this thing comes from. And then the discussion just takes a whole wrong turn very quickly. In some cases, which is the best scenario, the bill gets withdrawn. In some cases, which is the bad scenario, a law gets fast-tracked, or an amendment to a law gets fast-tracked. Now, in our case, all these things at least happen without any dust being kicked up. Without any dust being kicked up. What I'm always glad for, yes, I'm always glad for it, is that when I sometimes go and look up the history of certain African discussions, and I get into the encyclopedias of the world, it's primarily because I use the British one, Britannica, and I go read up about particularly African events, I'm always grateful that someone actually recorded these particular events, because the narrative that we sometimes have about former African leaders is a problematic narrative. It's the same thing that the Americans also suffer from, but I'm not speaking on behalf of them, and they definitely don't speak on behalf of me. But we're talking about Africans, fellow Africans here. The question that you need to ask yourself is, how many of you knew, like I discovered in my research for this morning's session, that Lumumba technically was not innocent in his own demise? He was not innocent. As I said, I feel sorry for how the man met his demise and for what the man experienced. But here's the reason that the Soviets were called into his country. Here's the reason that the UN peacekeeping force was called into the country. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we quickly take a short musical break. And after the musical break, we come back right after it, heading into the second half of this morning's discussion here on your number one talk radio station. And this is my Sunday morning take.
I love you.
Show me.
Something got me started. You know that I will love you. Lately since we parted, truly know that I need you. I give it all up for 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 you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Broken-hearted, guilty of what I did to you. Lately since we parted, I truly know that I need you.
Yes, I do, because I give it all up for you.
it all up for you. I give it all up for you. I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes.
I'm gonna do the right thing. Let me tell you now, hip and
That was a little sparkle of Simply Red coming out with a song, the two songs there, with the first, the one that you just ended now, The Right Thing. Before that was Something Got Me Started. But anyway, getting back to our somber discussion that we had just before the break, and obviously you're still here in my company. If you've just woken up, I do hope that you've got something hot in your hand at least, not look like me with just my flask of room temperature water. But anyway, we left off primarily with looking at the particular chapter that ended just before the break in the, you know, the Diashi province of Katanga calling independence, and primarily where the main impacts basically were the political impasse between the prime minister of the country, which was at that stage Monsieur Lumumba, and the president of the country being Monsieur Kasavubu. Have to get the names right, guys. Get the names right. Now, remember, Lumumba and Kasavubu both appealed to the UN Security Council to send a peacekeeping force, and that the said particular peacekeeping force has to do the dirty work. Why does that sound very similar to what Tshisekedi did, requesting a military support in order to come and do the dirty work for his army? Why isn't his army intervening? Or his own police intervening, for that matter? We will not know. However, as the process of fragmentation set in motion, specifically by Katanga's cessation, and this is obviously as it continues to just pick up steam and to become even worse, this resulted in the breakup of the country into four separate fragments at the time. And this happened in 1960. This all happened in 1960. There was Katanga, there was Kasai, there was the Oriental Province, and there was Leopoldville. Now, the Army Chief of Staff at the time, Joseph Mobutu, who later on became, this is where the main protagonist, or if you wish to call him now an antagonist, as I would call him now, Monsieur Mobutu Sese Seko, his actual name, as you heard now, was Joseph Mobutu, took power in a coup d'etat. Classic. Classic. Finding an opportunity under the right circumstances to strike and thus achieve your personal goals. Well, Monsieur Mobutu Sese Seko, or Joseph Mobutu, achieved his particular goal. He announced on 14 September 1960 that the army would henceforth rule with the help of a caretaker government. This also sounds very familiar specifically to what was promised in, what's the country's name that we spoke about on Friday? Gabon. Yeah. This sounds very familiar to the Gabonese developments recently. Promising a transition to a peaceful, you know, reaching a peaceful scenario, but thus the peace is reached by a military man. Now, the threat posed to the new regime by the forces loyal to Lumumba was substantially lessened by the capture of Lumumba in December of 1960. Now, after a dramatic escape from Leopoldville the previous month, and by his subsequent execution at the hands of the Tombe government. So Lumumba was handed over by Mobutu to the Katanga government, the newly formed Katanga situation, and he was executed there. Now, although Kasavubu had had Lumumba arrested and delivered to the Katanga cessationists, which was intended to pave the way for a reintegration of the province, it was not until January of 1963, and only after a violent showdown between the European-trained Katanga gendarmerie and the UN forces, that the cessation was decisively crushed. Another cessation challenge emerged on 7 September 1964 when the pro-Lumumba government in Stanleyville, which is now known as Kisangani, declared much of eastern Congo to be the People's Republic of Congo. This cessation was brought to heel the following year, in 65. Meanwhile, following the convening of the parliament in Leopoldville, a new civilian government that was headed by Cyril Adula came to power on 2 August of 1961. Now, Adula's inability to deal effectively with the Katanga cessation and his decision to dissolve the parliament in September of 1963 critically undermined his popularity. Because I still want to know, and this is primarily for the political... But I'll ask David anyway tomorrow. Don't worry, guys. I'll ask him tomorrow. But I'll also ask my own internal, you know, family-related political scientist as well, because the one is Namibian-trained, the other one is South African-trained. I'll ask this question in terms of why do some African leaders, or in the developing countries or the Global South, why do some leaders in the Global South believe that dissolving the parliament is the way to go to achieve their goals? Please, someone, help me understand this particular technique. If I voted for people to sit in a parliament, even if my vote was just one vote that got that one guy into the National Assembly, why does another politician who became the president, the prime minister of a country, believe the parliament, meaning my vote, must be dissolved after he or she were also voted into the same station, or they actually achieved their particular station through the same means? Why do they believe that dissolving a parliament is the way to go? Because it still feeds into the evidence that was highlighted to me by a resource that I discovered, that politicians in many cases are psychopaths. They do things that you ask the question. It's not even a question of legality or laws. You just go and stand and think, but did you think about this when you are doing this thing? No, really, guys. Just think to yourselves sometimes. Did you think about this when you went and did this thing? I keep it hanging there because dissolving a parliament. Yeah. Usually shows primarily that there is a lot of issues primarily between whoever is the president, whoever is the ruling party, whoever are the opposition parties, and whoever are the main particular voices and talking points in this scenario. Now, a scenario of dissolving your parliament is not the most promising avenue, because you're technically telling the other political parties this, you never had an intention of working with them. You're technically telling them you never wanted to work with them beforehand, and that, you know, you were putting up a ruse, you were putting up an act. But it's an action that continues to happen every time. It's an action that happens every time across the global south. And it usually starts from things of trying to bring in a bill or a law or something that tries to do something. And then the opposition guys who were at in a previous stage, probably in many cases now, from what you would see, the opposition guys, the guys who are now opposition, who were the ruling party before they lost the last election, would then just decide to oppose anything that the new president and his or her cabinet bring in. And thus, you sit with an issue. You sit with an issue. In some cases, guys, there's a reason why they offer strategy courses, you know, which are now accessible from UCT, Stellenbosch, that's not South Africa, UNISA in South Africa. I have not seen any Namibian-based ones. What's the other one? From across the world, there's Harvard ones, there's Stanford ones, there's London School of Economics ones. The reason why they offer specifically like strategy, business strategy, and like just overall strategy courses, because strategy is also supposed to help you understand that if you commit something which is against the law, that you know about the risks that you face and the risks that you're going to cause. Remember, the risks you face and the risks you are causing or will cause. There's a reason as to why you now find in many governments, in many corporate companies, you find a position or a department known as risk management department. And is this usually affiliated to the financial sector? Risk management. Or the department would have an extra dimension to it. Risk and compliance department. Now, risk and compliance, I always thought this was I always thought it probably sounded like an occupational health and safety scenario, or it was an HR-related scenario. And then when you go look at the people that work in there and their backgrounds and their educational expertise, you realize they're either lawyers or they're either accountants. Now, you would ask, why would you put an accountant there? Because an accountant, dear listeners, also has to know about laws. Laws that impose fiduciary responsibilities on his or her accounting sector. Did you know that? Accountants have it's literally like a legal responsibility. It is like a legal responsibility to uphold the best version of their profession. Now, fiduciary is a pretty strong word, but them, doctors, engineers, there's someone else that I'm forgetting. It's them, doctors, engineers. There's another cluster of experts. Lawyers. Yeah. So it's accountants, doctors, engineers, lawyers. These four people. Nah. They need to have a government recognized industry regulating body, meaning if you go study engineering today and you get your engineering degrees, you go and register with that engineering board or engineering council at Ministry of Works and Transport. If you go and study medicine, doesn't matter where it is, South Africa, Namibia, wherever you are, you get your how many levels of educational background and qualification, you come back to Namibia, you have to go and register with the Health Professions Council of Namibia, which is recognized and affiliated to the Ministry of Health. When you go and finish your law degrees and levels, you register with the Law Society of Namibia, which is recognized by the Ministry of Justice. And when you go and the accounting one is now the one that has to be affiliated to that SOE known as PAAB, Public Accountant and Auditors Board, PAAB, which is an SOE, basically. You have to go register there because they are recognized by Ministry of Finance, because Ministry of Finance has state-owned enterprises under its name, and it's one of those particular entities. So, in a nutshell, these guys know that the role they play is primarily to firstly to have a ethical dimension in the economy. It's inserted there. So an engineer has to make sure that whatever project they're working on is ultimately for a good cause. A doctor knows that whatever they are doing, a doctor and a nurse, whatever they are doing in any medical facility, private or public, it's for a good cause. It's to save lives. It's to improve lives. A lawyer knows that they're obviously going to practice under the laws of Namibia, to work in conjunction with the laws of Namibia, and the i.e., because I'm not going to impose a moral responsibility on them because I have no such power. It's like I said, it's up to lawyers are probably the only profession I don't like because they know all the loopholes legally. Even though Helmut and I, we make the jokes here on the Home Run, legally they know the loopholes. It's not a detriment, probably, to the people they are facing that will face them, but they are doing their job, primarily. If they are representing a client and they can find the loopholes in legislation, the loopholes in laws, the loopholes in punishment, the loopholes in resolving disputes, then they know their work very well. And then finally, when it comes to the accountants, guys, their particular expertise has financial implications. Let me just say it. Their expertise has financial implications. Now, getting you back to the Congo crisis. It's the reason why I use those four sectors, professions, to basically make the statement about politicians and their antics and their actions. Now, guys, when you look at politics in Namibia, please, firstly, let me give you an assignment. Go and read up about political science. And in an African context, try to look at the African school of thought. The Namibian one obviously is based upon the history that you would have been exposed to, that you know, that you've lived for the past 36, 37 years, or for how long you've been a Namibian in your life. Work from that particular perspective. Why am I giving you this particular, assignment for your own particular benefit? Well, if you go and look at political science as a dimension, political science helps to explain, and it has a lot of history in it. It has a lot of history in it, and it, many of its particular analysis is based upon historical events, just like economics, primarily like economics. But economics tries to ignore political economy, like the economist that I love watching every morning, because he makes videos every day. Richard Murphy and his friend Steve Keen, they both say, because they're academics, that the economists that they've seen show up on TV shows around the world, they ignore the political economy, meaning the influence that politicians from a ruling party who are now the presidents, the prime ministers of the world, have on an economy, have on people in the economy, have on people in the country, have on sectors, have on markets, have on trade, have on resources, which is, in many aspects, a very dangerous perspective to have, because it technically ignores a fundamental ingredient in the analysis, the role of a politician and the policies that they bring about. Now, you can clearly see, because we don't know what were some of the contentious points between Kasavubu and Lumumba. We only know, in terms of a summarized version, that Kasavubu and Lumumba technically did not like each other. Because I am assuming they did not like each other. For Kasavubu to arrest Lumumba and then hand Lumumba over to cessationists of Kasavubu's own province of Katanga, that he's supposed to be governing over, definitely shows you that there was a level of malice beyond imagine. A level of malice so great that the stories I've heard up until today ignores the existence of Kasavubu, the actions that Kasavubu had taken, the actions of Lumumba himself. It's an important thing to know. No? And this is a scary thought. Now, back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you know, information was scarce. Imagine being a person back in the 60s, the 70s, and 80s with experiencing this level of political turmoil and instability. Imagine being someone living in that period. Imagine back then where uncertainty was the order of the day. You went to bed with uncertainty, and the next morning you wake up and there's further uncertainty. Now, the dissolution that Abdullah's actions, the dissolution of the parliament that Abdullah caused or enacted, contributed directly to the outbreak of rural insurgencies. Get this particular statistic. These rural insurgencies engulfed 5 of 21 provinces between January and August of 1964. And it raised again the prospect of a total collapse of the central government. Because of its poor leadership and the fragmented basis of support, the rebellion failed to translate its early military successes into effective political power. Even more important in turning the tide against the insurgents was a decisive intervention by European mercenaries. And I think that's where the movie, what's the movie's name that Christopher Walken starred in? Dogs of War. That was the movie's name, yeah. I watched the movie. It annoyed me a bit. It annoyed me a bit. I'll explain to you why the movie annoyed me a bit. Because it was at a time that, and it was a story that was written by Frederick Forsyth. If you don't know who Frederick Forsyth is, he's actually a novelist. But Forsyth is also responsible for writing the very famous, which is now a TV series, another famous TV series, The Day of the Jackal. Because the Jackal actually lived. He was a real life hitman. But the Dogs of War aspect or book sounded very familiar to an event in Africa. Too familiar. Well, it was technically also based on taking place in Africa. If you looked into the description of the movie, Dogs of War, it is based on actual events. Most of the characters are fiction. They changed the names. Frederick Forsyth changed the names. But it is all based on true events that actually happened in human history. Because Frederick Forsyth, just like Stieg Larsson, the guy that wrote The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, they were both journalists who then became novelists. Now, a journalist who becomes a novelist, in many cases, realizes that there's a real-life event that they want to write a stories on, and then they do so. Dogs of War, in its own right, the one guy is explaining here, and this is a Reddit post, and I will advise you not to read about the Reddit. But Dogs of War is based upon supposedly what happened in the Afghan, in the Afghan War. But the downside is the movie came out in 1980, and Dogs of War is based in Africa. The movie is based in Africa. Which has you asking questions, is it trying to emulate events that took place in Africa? Because the Afghan War is, the War Dogs. So that's the movie War Dogs, sorry. I mean, many of the particular scenarios obviously that stems from this is one that you can see similarities popping up. And said particular similarities obviously should highlight to you that, something feels a little bit off about the storytelling. But yeah, it's a movie nonetheless. It made its money. It was from a book. It also made its money. You know, obviously someone profited from real life events. Now, I'm not telling you to go watch War Dogs. Dogs of War, not War Dogs. War Dogs is the one about, what's the guy's name? Someone else, yeah, it's an American perspective, even though there are American actors in the Dogs of War movie. Now, this dissolution of power that took place by Abdullah, when Abdullah hired the European mercenaries after 63, they actually helped the central government regain control over the rebel-held areas. But much of the credit for the survival of the government also goes to Tshombe, the secessionist leader of Katanga, who, by 10 July of 1964, had replaced Abdullah as prime minister. Literally. Now this brings in the comedy of the situation as well, because it does sound comedic, because you can literally see how four guys were trying to sort of like impose themselves in terms of running the government of what was early DRC. A year and a half after 1964, after the defeat, after his particular defeat at the hands of UN forces, that's now Tshombe, the most vocal advocate of secession actually emerged as the providential leader of the central government. The central government did not know what to do, did not know where to go, did not know how to respond, did not know how to act, did not know how to negotiate. And remember, this is immediately after Lumumba's death. This is as Mobutu obviously committed a coup d'etat. This is as Kasavubu, despised Lumumba, but Kasavubu also didn't have a plan or a direction. And Tshombe came out as being as the most, promising person to try and stabilize affairs in the 5 years since 1960 to 65. In the 5 year span, Tshombe, the cessationist, the guy who committed treason, became the most sort of like stabilizing option for Congolese. But then things went sour pretty quickly. Super quickly. The souring brings us to the gentleman that we know as Mobutu Sese Seko, who, as we know, his actual name is Joseph Mobutu. So, Senor, or Monsieur, since he's French-speaking, Monsieur Mobutu, then decided, for the fun of it, to have a second coup. On 24 November 1965. And this occurred in the circumstances that were strikingly similar to those that had led to the first coup that he enacted, which was, there was a power struggle between the incumbent president, Kasavubu, and his prime minister at the time, Tshombe. Now, in two scenarios, there's one constant variable that is problematic. And as you can see, it seems like it's Monsieur Kasavubu once again. Because from Lumumba to Tshombe, trying to be a prime minister, trying to supposedly to do your work. I say supposedly because, I didn't live back then in 1965, so I didn't have the opportunity of observing. Is that you can see that Kasavubu potentially is an issue. Now, Mobutu's coup, or his second coup, saw the removal of Kasavubu and Tshombe. And Mobutu himself then decided to resume the presidency. Now, unlike Lumumba, Tshombe managed to leave the country unharmed. And he was determined to regain control. Rumors that the ousted prime minister was plotting a comeback from exile in Spain hardened, became louder into certainty, and in July of 1966, some 2,000 of Tshombe's former Katanga gendarmes, which were led by mercenaries, mutinied in Kisangani. Exactly 1 year after the crushing of that first mutiny, a second one broke out, again in Kisangani, apparently triggered by the news that Tshombe's airplane had been hijacked over the Mediterranean and it was forced to land in Algeria, where he was also held as a prisoner, and he later on died of a heart attack in Algiers. Now, led by a Belgian settler named Jean Schramer, and including approximately 100 former Katanga gendarmes and about 1,000 Katangese, the mutineers then held their ground against the 32,000-man Congolese National Army, the Armée Nationale Congolaise, also known as the ANC, not to be confused with the African National Congress of South Africa, And this particular fight lasted until November 1967. And that is when the mercenaries crossed the border into Rwanda and surrendered to the local authorities over there. Now, Skrama himself later on turned up in Brazil, where he remained in spite of attempts by the Belgian government to have him extradited. The country, obviously, that's not the DRC, settled into a semblance of political stability for the next 7 years. This allowed Mobutu to focus on his unsuccessful strategies for economic progress. In 1971, Mobutu renamed the country Zaire as part of his authenticity campaign, his effort to emphasize the country's cultural identity, and officially described it as the nation politically organized. That's now Mobutu's MPR, the political party that existed at the time, then became the sole political party from 1970 to 1990. But MPR may be better seen as a weakly articulated patronage system that actually came into force. You obviously know what patronage is, you know, people paying you so that you do something for them, which is basically what Trump is doing, a patronage system. Mobutu's effort to extol the virtues of Zairean authenticity did little to lend respectability either to the concept or to the brand of leadership for which this authenticity stood for. Now, his chiefly image, in terms of the image that Mobutu placed himself in, was that his rule was based on bonds of personal loyalty between himself and his entourage, which also sounds very similar to Donald Trump's situation. Transactional, definitely. You get rewarded, for example, for what he did, what you did for him. And then he either gives you a contract or he gives you a high-ranking government position. In Mobutu's case, the historians have assessed that his power was pretty fragile, or his power base was pretty fragile. And this was demonstrated in 1977 and 1978 when the country's main opposition movement, the Congolese National Liberation Front, the Front de la Libération Nationale Congolaise, or the FLNC, operating from Angola, of all places, launched two major invasions into Shaba, which was called Katanga from 1972 to 1997. And on both occasions, external intervention by friendly governments, primarily Morocco in 77 and France in 78, saved the day, but at the price of many African and European casualties. Shortly after the capture of the urban center of Kolwezi by the FLNC in May of 1978, an estimated 100 Europeans lost their lives at the hands of the rebels and not the ANC party from South Africa, but the ANC of Mobutu. Apart from the role that was played by the FLNC in spearheading the invasions, a sharp deterioration of the Zairean economy after 1975 took place. This was coupled with a rapid growth of anti-Mobutu sentiment among the poor and the unemployed. And as it was crucial, because this was a crucial factor, in the near success of the invasions from Shaba. The timing of the first Shaba invasion, which was a full 11 years after the creation of the popular movement of the revolution, the Mouvement Populaire de la Révolution, or the MPR, in 1966, this underscored the shortcomings of the single-party state as a vehicle for national integration and of Mobutuism as an ideology for the legitimization of Mobutu's regime. Now, that, dear listeners, brings us about 5 minutes out from the top of the hour here on your number one talk radio station. We'll quickly be taking a short musical break. We'll be coming back after that, saying our goodbyes and our good mornings, obviously at the top of the hour at 7 a.m. And yes, this was a quick rundown, specifically of looking at the Congo crisis in its heart, at that was at the core primarily of Lumumba's passing. So we come back there from the sounds of Simply Red with A New Flame. Look, man, these guys are just good. That's why I play them a lot. But that technically will bring us to the end of this morning's discussion here on your number one talk radio station. And this has been my Sunday morning take. Now, I see the sun has not popped out as yet. It is 7 a.m. And on that note, dear listeners, stay tuned for the rest of the programming to follow on after the music.